You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. My name is Ryan Haas, and I'm a fellow at the Brookings Institution. It is my honor and pleasure to welcome an audience from across the United States and around the world to this live webcast conversation between Jung Park and Sue Terry to roll out Jung's new book, which hit bookshelves today. Jung's book, titled Becoming Kim Jong-un, a former CIA officer's insights into North Korea's enigmatic young dictator, could not be more timely. The book provides a masterful insight into who Kim Jong-un is, what makes him tick, and what keeps him up at night. The book has already earned wide praise from among the leading thinkers and former policy practitioners dealing with North Korea issues. And we're fortunate that Jung and Sue will spend the next hour with us breaking down what we need to know about how North Korea operates, who Kim Jong-un is, and what is going on in North Korea these days. Jung and Sue bring a wealth of knowledge to this conversation. They both are former intelligence analysts who represent the very best of their previous profession. They each were tremendous colleagues while in government, and they are tremendous friends to me now. And in addition to being deeply informed, kind, and deadly smart, they're also a ton of fun. So before I turn it over to Jung and Sue, I do want to note that we already have collected many questions from members of the audience and welcome you to send more. You can do so by sending an email to events@brookings.edu. or via Twitter at #becomingkim. With that, it is my delight to turn it over to Sue and Jung.
Thank you, Ryan, for the kind introduction. Of course, we are all, you know, here mutual fan club. Jung and I are also great fans of Ryan. He's a great friend, colleague, astute thinker, and scholar of China and all things Asia. Just one of the most stand-up people we know. So thank you, Ryan. So let's get started. I know the question that's foremost on everyone's mind is, Jung, what did you do? The timing of your book launch is so remarkable, it's a bit suspicious. But all kidding aside, what the heck is going on with Kim Jong-un and whether Kim is alive or incapacitated or recovering? Don't answer that yet. We'll get to that. But first, I just wanted to give a little bit of a background on us, a little bit more of how I met Jung. I first met Jung in, I don't know, early 2008, late 2007. I was at the time at the National Intelligence Council preparing to go to the National Security Council. I already left the agency when I got a call from my boss, my former boss from the CIA. He was breathless about, you know, this wonderful woman who came for an interview and how she would make this superb analyst. And CIA gave her a conditional offer, but they were not able to close the deal, and my mission was to close the deal with Jung. So I agreed to help him, and when I first met Jung, we exchanged emails, and when I first met her, it was at Starbucks inside the CIA, and there was this long hallway, and I still remember the very first day I met her, I was walking down the hallway, she's looking great, she's always so fashionable, I still remember the shoes she was wearing, and of course, as he predicted, we hit it off. We decided to meet that night for dinner in Washington, D.C. in some wine bar. We met. It was supposed to be a short dinner. She was supposed to have some sort of 9 p.m. conference call. Before we knew it, you know, she was taking the call outside of the restaurant in the middle of the street. And before we knew it, it was wee hours of the morning, and the rest is history. She's been a great friend and colleague since then, a confidant. We collaborate together whenever we can. She's also a role model for me as a scholar, as an analyst, as a mom. So I can't be happier to share this day with her, launching our book. So I also want to make a quick toast to Jung. I don't know if you can see the champagne. Before the coronavirus era, we were planning this book launch event. We were supposed to do it in person at Brookings with this champagne toast and all. So even though we're doing this via Zoom, there's no reason why we can't do a champagne toast as we promised. So here's to Jung, and congratulations on your book, on this achievement. This is the most thoughtful, insightful assessment of the young enigmatic leader of North Korea. So timely too. So proud of you, and cheers.
Cheers. Thank you, Sue. But I need you to turn on your video so I can see you.
Okay. How do I do that?
There you go. Thank you so much. You're so amazing. I can't think of a better person to celebrate this. Thank you.
So before we start talking about Kim Jong-un and North Korea, I do want to spend a few minutes talking about what it is like to cover a country like North Korea and a person like Kim Jong-un as an analyst. So your book begins with you talking about the difficulty of analyzing North Korea, the difficulty of your job as an analyst at the CIA, making the hard call. And as you know, I started at the CIA 2 days before 9/11, and my years at CIA covered Kim Jong-il. And of course, your CIA career began just after Kim Jong-il's stroke, and your CIA years covered Kim Jong-un. And between us, from Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un, we have 2 decades of covering North Korea. But we would both agree that North Korea is indeed the hardest of hard target countries. Could you talk a little bit about your job as a North Korea analyst in the U.S. intelligence community, how you analyze the vast array of information and misinformation, connecting the dots? You talk about how North Korea analyst's job is like putting together pieces of puzzle, received at different times, different places, different pieces of puzzle mixed in, and so on. Can we start with that?
Yeah, and so thank you to Ryan for that amazing introduction and for those kind words. And to Sue, I can never get tired of your telling people about our first date. This is the rated PG conversation, so she left out a lot of stuff in that opening. So Sue, thank you for doing this. I'm so glad that we were able to do this at least virtually with our audience. Though we can't do this in person. So I think what's so interesting about how our paths cross is that you cover the father and I cover the son, and our paths crossed at the agency. And I think that what, even on the CIA website, the recruitment website, you can see things like, you know, work for us at the CIA because we, help us to learn to connect the dots. This is like a puzzle where you have different puzzles coming in at different times, from different periods, from different places, and you have to figure that out. But I think in the North Korea issue, And we see this now with all of this fragmentary information that's coming in about whether Kim Jong-un is alive or ill or whatever the case may be, is that because of North Korea's specific practices on operation security and their information security, it makes North Korea the hardest of the hard targets. And as you know, this is something that always rang true throughout the building in Langley. So I think, you know, North Korea the regime doesn't want information to get out to the outside or within North Korea itself. And because of that, you have only a small circle of advisors, maybe a handful, who might know where or what Kim is doing at any given moment. And I think that is designed to make sure that no one gets any crazy ideas about starting protests or getting together or colluding against the regime. But it's also to make sure that the people on the outside, the United States, South Korea, China, also to keep them in the dark about where the regime is. So given all of that, I think a lot of improvements have been made over the years, but given all that, the North Koreans' operation security, their tight hold on information makes it really difficult to actually look here inside North Korea.
Yeah. You know, in your book, you talk about Richard Hewer's book. You reference his book on how intelligence analysts need to work through the weaknesses and biases in our thinking, how we need to continually check and review our key assumptions. And I found that to be, I mean, it's very true. I mean, I think that's one of the most thoughtful thing about your book, about the need for checking our assumptions, right?
And you know this book, right? I mean, we probably had 5 or 6 different copies given to us at any given point. And so everybody, if you walk into any CIA analyst office, former or in Langley, you'll see this book on their bookshelf, whether over to the side or somewhere. But it reminds me of, one of the things about being a North Korea follower is that North Korean analyst, is that it's extremely frustrating, right? So that yes. it's you have to live with all of this ambiguity and provide answers when there are no answers. And so it's a lot of mental and also emotional gymnastics to try to get at this target. And the stakes are high, right? I mean, there's a reason North Korea is a target. North Korea is a hard target. And the reason that we study North Korea so much is because it has nuclear weapons. And it's positioned in the middle of the most vibrant, economically vibrant parts of the world in Asia. It sits between China and South Korea. That's also where the U.S. troops are present in South Korea and in Japan. And so given all of those factors and the fact that we don't have very much absolute insight into the leadership's intentions, that makes this a very dangerous place. And it really requires a lot of checking of the assumptions. Otherwise, we're just following a wrong path.
One more question on CIA before we move on to North Korea. What do you think is the biggest misperception people have about the agency, and what is it like not being in the government anymore? What do you miss and not miss? Is it weird not having top secret, access to top secret sources?
Yeah, so when I arrived at Brookings in September of 2017, after almost 9 years at the agency, I remember sitting at my desk and looking at my one screen. Remember how we had multiple screens? Just looking at my one small screen and feeling I was deaf, dumb, and blind. What do people do for information? What are they listening to? What are they seeing? Who's talking to them? And you know, what are the governments saying, right? That was a really difficult transition. You have to find others, and now you have to find other sources of information. Right. I think that was. I think you found that too. That when you left, that it was. It was difficult to acclimate to new information environment. What did you think when you left?
No, what do I not know? I felt, you become an information obsessed. So now you don't have it. So that's like you go through this withdrawal syndrome, okay. Right? Okay. So moving on to Kim, I know we'll get to the status of his health and all that later. But in your book, you mentioned that there's a tendency by analysts and scholars and media to portray Kim Jong-un as a cartoon figure, right? A 10-foot tall baby. And there's a tendency to simultaneously underestimate, overestimate Kim's capabilities. And you say with his capabilities, with his intentions, questioning his rationality. And of course, Kim Jong-un is not the only one who was caricatured. I remember when I was covering Kim Jong-il, we similarly caricatured Kim Jong-il. He was portrayed as a cartoon figure too, making fun of his bouffant hair, his platform shoes, and his obsession with films and womanizing and so on. Team America, remember? I'm so lonely, you know? So could you talk to us a little bit about that, Kim Jong-un being portrayed as this cartoon figure and the consequences of implications of doing that?
It's easy to caricature the Kim regime. I mean, you know this, you've seen this all your life. In your career. And it's, I think it's because of that absence of deep knowledge about North Korea. And I think, when they're the two Kims are very easy to caricature because of the way they, and that's one of the things that, that I wanted to do with this book is to provide a fuller picture. And it depends on where your gaze is. And I think this is where, Richard Hoyer's comments about mirror imaging, that you can't be, projecting your own assumptions or your own beliefs and what I would do in that situation into their position. I think the whole crazy moniker that goes to how can they do this? Why would they do this? Don't they know we would hit them and destroy? You know, the U.S. would destroy them. This doesn't make any sense. But when you have when you look from the North Korea or the Kim perspective, it's not crazy, and that's something that I try to explain. Like, what are the drivers of all of his actions? What is his historical baggage? What is he mindful of? What does he fear? What does he aspire to? And how does that evident or manifest in his actions So what might seem crazy and unpredictable and irrational to us is actually rooted in rationality on the part of Kim.
So in writing your book, what most surprised you about Kim Jong-un? Has your view of him changed over the years since he took over? Has he exceeded your expectations?
So the 2018 was really jarring. Remember that? When Kim did this abrupt switch and everyone seemed to be talking about how he is different. Yes, he is different from his father and his grandfather. He's different. He wants to, in doing a pivot at the Olympics and engaging with South Korea and the United States after years of holding his neighbors at bay, that he was different. This is, he studied in the West and he has a wife and he has, he wants to be more modern. And so we have to grab this opportunity. And that was disconcerting. And again, this goes back to how deeply uncomfortable it is to be an analyst of North Korea, is that it made me challenge my assumptions about Kim. What are we seeing and what does that mean? And what is really driving this outreach at this particular point? And I remember we were at a conference, Sue, and there was a really blustery, threatening statement back, after the pivot. And all of us were like, oh yeah, that's the North Korea that we know. the issuing of threats and telling us that they're going to use their weapons, all of that. But I think, I tried to get in the book is to show that he's still learning from us. He's still growing. He's still adapting, and that we have to be ready and be flexible to be able to adjust our analyses based on the situation.
Do you have a fun fact that people don't know about him? Most people don't know about him. Like for example, Kim Jong-il. I know that his favorite food of all time was sushi, but not only sushi. Fatty tuna. Yeah.
I think what as I was writing, and you know how sometimes when you write, the more you feel like you're learning from the writing process. What I thought was really interesting is the role of women in North Korea and his use of his wife. So I thought that was what was really interesting. This is different too, because Kim Jong-il did not have his wives or his consorts out in the public. They tried to keep them in the back, keep the women in the background as much as possible. But I thought that was, there are many reasons why he would bring his wife to the fore. And one is that he was young and his father told him to get married just before he was, in 2009. Yeah. Told him to get married because, although this isn't explicit, because it would make him into a man, right? And in Korean culture, you're not a man until you get married and have your own family. And so that gave him that gravitas being this married, stable man. And I think, and I know we're going to be talking about what's happening now, but I also think that the reason he introduced his wife so early on in his rule, or that he introduced his wife at all, is that he wanted to make sure that this is the succession line. Kim Jong-il had a ton of women, right? And Kim Jong-un, we don't know if he has, he's messing around, but he wants to have this image of a family-centered man. So I think that I suspect that he's thinking ahead. He's thinking ahead in terms of succession. There should be no jockeying in the background over which line of the family is going to get is going to be the next in line. And so I think that it makes me understand, and I hope it's apparent to the readers, is that he thinks ahead, and he's not this 20 something year old kid anymore, but he's a 36 year old.
That actually was one of my favorite part of your book, is your observations, woman, particularly on that chapter on Kim Jong-un's wife, First Lady of North Korea. And her role, you link her role with North Korea's soft power engagement, with Kim teasing the world with a promise of a different, more peaceful, pliant, charming, and modern North Korea. That's your phrase. How she normalizes Kim's status, not just as a leader of North Korea's nuclear power, as a nuclear power, but you mentioned as a husband, as a father, as a legitimate ruler on par with people like President Moon, President Xi, President, you know, Trump. And you write in your book, I have a quote here I wanted to read to you. This is because the carefully curated public appearances of Social Ju provide the regime with a softer side, a thin veneer of style and good humor to mask the brutality, starvation, and deprivation endured by the people, while reports about the existence of a possibly multiple children hint at the couple's fecundity. Nice SAT word, by the way. but yeah, I think that was definitely illuminating. So then let's talk about his sister a little bit, Kim Yo-jong too. Because that now everybody's talking about her potential role and possibly succeeding if something were to happen to Kim Jong-un. You have thoughts on her sister, his sister?
Yeah, so I think he, it's clear that he doesn't trust anybody else. He trusts his full-blooded siblings. They share a mother and the father. So and Kim went through the past few years of pruning the family tree, getting rid of the side branches or marginalizing the side branches. So I think it's anyone's guess, but the Kim Yo-jong, the full sister, is in a position to be potentially a regent role for Kim Jong-un's children as they grow up and potentially take over. But this is anyone's guess. So there's a lot of speculation about where Kim is and who might take over if he is incapacitated or dead. But these are real questions. I mean, North Korea, regardless of where Kim is, whether he's at his beach resort or somewhere else, North Korea still has nuclear weapons. They have a cache of biological and chemical weapons. They have sophisticated cyber capabilities. So North Korea is a danger and a threat. And I think that this is a reminder. Kim's absence is a reminder about how we should be preparing for all of these various scenarios.
What is your best estimate of what is going on in North Korea right now? I know that we have so many conflicting reports and nobody knows, but what is your best what's your take? What's going on? So maybe while we wait for Jung to get back on, because we're having technical difficulties, maybe I should talk a little bit about what I think is going on, since everybody's already on and watching this. Just to talk a little bit about my sense of what's going on. I mean, obviously there's no confirmed reporting. No one knows. That's the answer. No one knows what's happening with Kim. But there are a couple of data points that I do find it interesting. Since April 11th, Kim Jong-un has not been seen. We know that. And while he has been out of public view in the past, it is highly unusual that he did miss two very important events, including April 15th celebration of his grandfather's birthday and the Army Day celebration just on Saturday. And now missing this April 15th celebration is significant, because Kim Jong-un has, I don't think, ever missed that event since coming to power. So that is noteworthy. And another interesting fact I do think is that it's curious that North Koreans are very quiet about all of this. You would think that, they do monitor the news or coming from the world, and they could come out and say, this is all fake news, but they're not doing that. That is also curious that North Korea is so quiet about all this. Is Jung on?
Okay. Sorry, I think it was the North Koreans trying to cut off the webinar early. So sorry about that, everybody.
Can I have your view? So I don't see you somehow. I don't see your face for some reason. I wonder I can. Anyway, go ahead.
You should appear in just a minute.
Okay. So, John, where were we? I think I was just asking you what your best estimate on state of Kim's health was. And while you were gone, I was just trying to sort of you know, talk about my, you know, just basically saying that we don't know what is what we, what's happening, but it is curious. Some things are, you know, things are unusual.
Something is off, but we're not going to know what it is. But the question, but the questions about, but the questions remain about what the implications are of his absence. And I think it would be in Kim's interest to show up sooner rather than later. The borders and the information penetration is not what it was like in 2014. It was not what it was like in 2008. And so rumors are going to get around. I also think it's interesting that all of this chatting is going on in the Chinese chat rooms, and that, and so, you know, all of this information, all of those rumors are going to get out. And I think it would probably, to Kim's benefit, an advantage to show up sooner rather than later.
And but you do think that Kim Yo-jong is most likely to succeed Kim Jong-un if something were to happen to him?
I think so. I think it would, given all of the resources that the government, that the regime has poured into elevating that family line, the bloodline, the Mount Baekdu family line, and in their propaganda, in all of their histories, in all of their education, and all of their landscapes and their museums, that it would be hard to not have a Kim family member, a full Kim family member at the head. And even if that person was a figurehead or regent, I think there would have to be a full family member at the helm.
And what kind of ruler would Kim Yo-jong be? Do you think she will pursue her brother's policies? You know, it's just with a woman's touch. What kind of ruler would she make?
So, I mean, let's look at, if we take the look at history, look what Kim Jong-un did. He got rid of five of the seven people who were helping him, at the funeral procession of his father, and he marginalized the other two by the time, you know, the first two or three years. And I think that, the Kim family is not strangers to brutality and repression, and they have to use it to make sure that they maintain their survival. And when we talk about regime survival, we're talking about the Kim family's survival, not the entirety of the government.
But if she were to take over, do you think North Korea will survive? Will the regime be stable?
I think in the near term, the elite would be very self-conscious about sticking their head up and raising their hand or trying to collaborate or collude, to their buddy on the West Coast or the East Coast. I understand Kim's purges of all of those, you know, over the past few years, hundreds of officials, as a way to keep the elite off kilter and to try to make sure that that no one's support or no one's networks get all very, you know, get very ossified or hardened into something. And so, so given that, I mean, I would expect to see purges. But I think in the near term, I don't think the elite are going to start rising up or anything to that extent. But that, I think we have to be careful about. Thinking of the regime as this fragile, it is fragile, but also there's a lot of resilience because there are a lot of entrenched interests, money or otherwise, money, power, that keeps the elite pretty much along the lines of what the regime line is. I also think that given all of the things that have been happening so far in terms of, the North Koreans, Kim has been pretty clear that the North Korea cannot trust anybody except for Kim to protect them. And if anything, I think what the past few years have shown is that the U.S. is not a reliable partner. South Korea is not a reliable partner. China is not a reliable partner. And that's something that I tease out in the book about how the regime has learned over the decades that the other countries, allies or not, will turn their back on you if push comes to shove.
So let's talk a little bit about North Korea's policies towards the United States and then U.S. policy towards North Korea before getting to audience questions. So first, if he's not incapacitated or dead and indeed is alive and well, what can we expect from Kim in the future? Do you think he will conclude a deal with Trump this year? Do you think he prefers to deal with Trump instead of President Biden? What's Kim's next steps?
Next steps this year or in the coming years, he shows
up. Right. He's alive and well.
I think, you know, what's interesting is that he came into the scene in 2011, 2012 with a lot of swagger. He said North Koreans didn't have to tighten their belts anymore. You know very well, Sue, that was his father's line, you know, during the famine. And that when he introduced his policy in 2013 of a dual track policy, Kim said that, you know, we can have nuclear weapons and economic prosperity. But what's interesting in the past year is that he told his people that there might have to be some belt tightening, that there is going to be a prolonged struggle with the United States, and that things are going to be hard, and that people are going to have to work harder, longer, faster. And so it seems as though that that Kim has closed the door on, or at least kept it a little bit open on engaging with the U.S. But I don't know if he would make any big moves now, given the U.S. elections coming and some of the uncertainties there. It would not be in his interest to make a deal at this point, given who knows what might happen after the election, and that these deals, whatever it is, would not be implemented. So I think what we're going to see we're probably going to see more ballistic missile tests, as the North Koreans have been testing. This is something that they do to try to improve their capabilities. I think we're going to see ramped up cyber activities. I think the UN panel of experts has and private research companies and think tanks have documented this very well. That's a low cost way of generating revenue for the regime. And so I think that's what we're going to see. Maintain his weapons, is going to try to bolster his rule, maintain his strength, or at least the optics of strength, and muddle through in the way that the U.S. will probably muddle through with North Korea policy in the coming months.
Usually in an election year, there are provocations. I agree with you. I don't think it's going to be a major provocation, such as an ICBM or a nuclear test, but I do think there's going to be provocations if Kim Jong-un comes back, where he has recovered. He also needs to show that he's strong, right, that he's not a weak person. And if you look at March, I mean, there was all these short-range missile tests. So I think he was gearing up to that, to more provocations. Do you think he prefers to deal with President Trump second term or President Biden?
I think things look pretty good for Kim in terms of foreign relations. He has a U.S. president who has praised him for his leadership and ignored his human rights violations. We don't have a human rights envoy to North Korea. The President Trump and the Trump administration has turned a blind eye toward the various, the shorter range ballistic missile tests and other provocative actions. The U.S.-South Korea relationship is not great. The burden sharing agreement is still outstanding, and there are thousands of Korean workers at the U.S. bases furloughed. Things with China, U.S.-China are not great. You know, they're trading barbs over who started Corona and who's doing a worse job with respect to the coronavirus. South Korea and Japan are fighting about, there's a trade dispute that blossomed into a full-on, full-scale conflict that turned into, that seeped into the security and economic realms. Based on how some of the disarray in the region, the absence or the lack of U.S. leadership at the highest levels in the region, and the fact that Kim has had pretty much a free rein in terms of these weapons testing, I think it would, if there was more of this kind of environment, that I think that it's these are net positive for Kim.
So what should be our policy towards North Korea? You write in your book that ultimately Kim is not a businessman. And wealth in President Trump's sense of the word is not what Kim is, and presumably the North Korean elites too, this is not what they're looking for. And that President Trump's mirror imaging led to policymaking that did not comport with realities, right? So Kim is highly unlikely to give up nuclear weapons in order to get a McDonald's franchise in Pyongyang, as you say. What is the right approach then? What would you recommend for either President Trump's second term or President Biden? What we should be doing?
I don't put that up front in the book. So, you know, I let the story develop. And looking at some of the episodes and looking at various parts of his personality, various parts of his life, and various parts of North Korea's history, and I build to that toward policy recommendations, and that's to and that was designed to show that that, you know, Kim is not just about security guarantees. And that he requires a hostile outside world to try to justify his reign. And the problem with President Trump's approach about this, you know, these beachfront condominiums and having great real estate, is that Kim does not want American entrepreneurs running around in his country setting up McDonald's franchises. He does not want people building railroads or fixing their infrastructure for him because he doesn't want non-North Koreans who are uncontrollable inside the country and infecting the country, his people with crazy ideas about market economies and democracy and good governance. So he doesn't want that. He's not a subcontractor that a hotelier from New York would is used to working with. But his drivers are different. His incentives are different, and I think we have to recognize that. I also think that what we do a great disservice to our policies and to the North Korean people, and I know you're a strong advocate of this too, Sue, is the idea of that we don't treat the North Korean people as an entity or as actors themselves, and that I think a lot of scholars and activists and think tank people are working on this. The problem with human rights is that it's not a key U.S. government priority. It's always on the lowest rank of priorities. You know, issues like that are seen usually as secondary or tertiary issues, if at all. And it's clear that this administration does not see human rights issues in North Korea as a priority at all. But I think we need to ramp up information penetration, give the people what they want, use technologies and work with technology companies and activists to try to get more information into North Korea.
Yeah, on human rights, actually, President Trump did begin with, when his term began, he did focus on human rights. I remember when he went to South Korea, you know, gave that State of Union address talking about North Korea's human rights abuses. Remember when he had a State of Union address, he did invite the North Korean defector and Otto Warmbier's family. And then all of a sudden that switched when he turned right from, you know, all this, you know, this maximum pressure to peace offensive and diplomacy and symmetry. All of a sudden he's completely dropped it. I completely agree with you on this information penetration. You know, for me, it's like, that's such a key to get information into North Korea, to help the people, break free from this information blockade. But right, agree with you on that. Okay, so we have a few minutes before we turn to audience. So I'm just going to ask you my last question. If Kim is alive and well and you got to spend some quality time with him, what would you say to him?
If I had quality time with him?
What would you ask him or say to him?
So this was a surprise question that you were going to...
No, but I mean, yeah, free people. I mean, like, you know, what should he do? Like, what would you say if you got to spend some quality time with him? He does drink.
You know what I would like to ask, you know, is what is the legacy that you want to leave behind? What is the legacy that you want to leave behind? And I think that, you know, most people would prefer that he would say, I want to have this peaceful peaceful North Korea where everybody's prosperous. And I suspect that when he was younger, maybe he had some of these thoughts. But I think that that it might, I wonder if what, you know, how have his ideals or his goals changed from 2012 to 2020? And what has he learned in, how optimistic was he in 2011, 2012 versus 2020, given the fact that he hasn't had sanctions removal, he hasn't had very much success on that front. So, I mean, I think that's what I would like to, that's something that I think would be really interesting to find out from him.
And what if he did, make a case to do better for his people. But yeah. What if he did die or pass or incapacitate? What if this is it? What is his legacy then?
It's the worst of what North Korea has to offer, in that the alleged equality of communism or socialism is gone. As people can't rely on the state for their daily necessities, they have to, it's almost Hobbesian in that, you eat what you kill in North Korea. And I think about this when I think about COVID in North Korea. There's no way, despite what the North Korean regime says about that there's zero infections. But the elite can get testing, I'm sure. The elite can go to the hospitals. Kim Jong-un is building this massive Pyongyang General Hospital in anticipation of having to treat the elite. But it's really the vast majority of the 25 million people in North Korea who are without safe water. They're scrounging around for food, and they have to rely on smuggling, human trafficking, sex slavery to try to get, scrape by. There are millions of stories in North Korea in terms of all these defector stories, I think, that which are so, they're so poignant about the triumph of the human will versus all of the burden and the repressiveness of this particular regime. Do you remember over the summer, there was a woman who died in her apartment in Seoul with her child. They were North Korean defectors, and they had died of starvation in South Korea after they had defected. And I wish that we could offer an alternative vision. And I think, Tae Young-ho, one of the most prominent defectors, his winning a National Assembly seat, I think, provides that sense of alternative vision. You know, we're good at talking about lots of things. We're good at talking about, nuclear weapons, how to do non-proliferation, and coercive diplomacy, et cetera. But I think we do a pretty bad job of showing North Korea what could be possible. And I think we really do have to ramp up the information penetration and focusing on how to get different ideas into North Korea.
I can't agree with you more. And I was very happy to see Taeyong-ho win, because I do think it sends the right message to the elites and potential defectors. Yeah. There is an alternate path to them. There is a life that's possible in South Korea. Okay, so we're going to get some questions from the audience. First question, we have a foreign affairs analyst from federal government. Sounds a lot like an intro person. Remember this? I work for the U.S. government. So this person asks, to what extent do you think Kim's appetite for risk has grown over time? You do talk about Kim Jong-un's brazenness and high risk tolerance in your book. Has his appetite grown for risk, or have grown over time?
One of the premises of the book is that Kim is watching us as much as we're watching him. And he learns from what we're doing and what we're not doing. And so there were many, many red lines, or, alleged red lines that he crossed, right? And you've seen this through Kim Jong-il's period too, right? From one nuclear weapon to two to six to eight. Based on what he's done, I mean, he's been very aggressive too in pressing the accelerator on the nuclear weapons program and conventional training, et cetera. But but there have been, other than sanctions, which the air was let out with the summits, that he's still standing. He did 3 ICBM tests in 2017. That long ago was a red line that that North Koreans would be inviting trouble if they did that. But they got sanctioned and so did a massive nuclear test as well. He threatened to during his reign, he's threatened to hit South Korea. He's done night training for commando raids. He has had mock displays of the South Korean presidential blue house so that they can do training on how to raid it. He's done some pretty brazen things, and but the punishment has been pretty subdued. There were sanctions. I thought there were the maximum pressure campaign was a good policy, but I think all of that kind of went away when President Trump said, "I don't even believe in maximum pressure," and that he's dismissing North Korea's human rights violations. So I think he's become bigger, badder, and bolder because he has perceived a lack of political will to respond to him or punish. And this, Sue, is that sanctions are hard to implement. You have to have China on your side. You have to make sure that all of our partners across the globe, wherever North Koreans are, have the capacity to find out illicit activities illicit activities that are taking place in their country. So I think he has a bigger acceptance for risk. But I also wonder, and this is something that I'll be watching for, is how much of the economic issues might tame that. What I worry about is that his default is aggressiveness, right? It's not, being chased and being self-reflective about what he needs to do, but that that sensing weakness in one sector, the economy, that he might go all in on the other sector, which is the nuclear weapons program and military readiness.
Well, and the economic situation is even more uncertain with this measures that they have taken to prevent coronavirus. Now they've taken some draconian measures effectively. So there's a secondary effect to that. So implications to the economy. And we'll see. So if he was sick or if they had a major surgery and he recovers, I wonder if that would make him more risky in the future in terms of his actions or what? I mean, must have a psychological impact, right?
Yeah, he has to show strength. Otherwise, how do you keep the elite in line? How do you keep the military in line? Which is strange to say for somebody who is overweight and has these issues. And it's striking to me how the inconsistency or the cognitive dissonance of this Kim Jong-un with his protruding belly, smoking a cigarette, and ordering the North Korean Navy to strip down and swim in the ocean for an impromptu drill, right? But he has to show strength, and his perception of strength is in doing these launches.
Right. Okay, a State Department fellow from Institute for Defense Analysis asked, it is said that North Korea's senior military leaders feared Kim Jong-il, but did not respect him. What is their view of Kim Jong-un? So, of course, as you know, one of the reasons why the regime survives is, one of the key pillars of stability is elite support, right? So we know that the elites have supported elite loyalty. There was elite loyalty towards Kim Il-sung, elite support to Kim Jong-il. What do you think of the elite's views of Kim Jong-un? How much do they really support him?
I'm not sure that, I'm not sure that that's exactly the best question. It's more, are they willing to, they're willing to support him in the way that he protects their lifestyle. And I think that's something to be mindful of, is that as odious as Kim Jong-un might be in his treatment of his people, there are still interests that are tied to him. And the way he has purged people and he's demoted and shuffled leaders around, that also means that they have a stake in the North Korean economy as it is. You know, the military and the party are very much involved in money-making operations. And the closer you are to the regime, the more money you can make, the more opportunities you can have. And so I think you have to think of it in terms of not loyalty to Kim Jong-un himself, but what he represents, that kind of stability and the privilege that they're used to.
Okay, do we have more questions? Someone was asking about this is more book related, Jung. How are you handling not in a book tour? I know today was a big day. You were hoping for a book tour. How are you handling that? And I'll just ask a follow-up question to that. This is your first book. What was the best part and worst part about writing this book?
So I was nervous, obviously, about the book tour and not being able to, you know, show people what I had done and what I had produced. But I think, you know, there's always a silver lining. And I think that having this webinar with you, Sue, it's different from having it in Brookings, in our auditorium that, you know, that holds maybe 150, 200 people. But with this, we can reach hundreds of people from across the country who can share in our conversation and hear about North Korea, especially given what's going on in the news. I think the worst part was writing late at night. It was having my Brookings day job, coming home, putting the kids to bed, you know, after dinner, and then starting work at 9 p.m. and working till 3 a.m. And doing that for a year. And now I still have that schedule where I can't sleep until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I get up at 7.
I thought you got that heavy blanket.
I got the gravity blanket, and it's not helping.
Oh, no. Okay. There's a question from, it just says from Washington, D.C. So that question that you just answered is from New Providence, New Jersey. This question is from Washington, D.C. How was Kim introduced to China as a young man? Did he travel to China? Does he have China advisors? Chinese advisors, I guess, what they're trying to say.
Yeah, one of the first things that he did as leader, as he was consolidating power, was that he killed his uncle by marriage in 2013. And one of the criticisms of him, in the indictment, was that he had too many contacts with the Chinese, and that he was more subservient to the Chinese and working with the Chinese. And that's something that you want to avoid when you're an official in North Korea, is having too much foreign contact, that it makes them highly suspicious. And of course, there were rumors during the grooming process that he went with his father to China. But the Chinese government was pretty open about this. There was no criticism. The Chinese government, Beijing, was the first to say congratulations, Kim Jong-un, on taking over after your father's death. And so I think that, you know, that was a, you have a, you had a Beijing at that point that was very cautious and sensitive to making sure that they have their contacts and making sure that they didn't offend Kim Jong-un. And so this is kind of like the tyranny of the weak, as one scholar had said, that that even though you have this very relatively weak country, you have people that you know, there is a sense that, you know, without North Korean stability, you need to have access to Kim and have some sort of relations with him.
One question was, has it become easier to analyze North Korea from the time of Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un, given that we have so many defectors running news services, sneaking cameras into North Korea, and presumably better technology?
Is it easier? Yeah, I think there is a lot of information, absolutely, in terms of how much because of technology. And this is all the result of, you know, activist work and defector organizations work and organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy. And so, as well as the State Department. So I think there is a lot of information. coming out. And some of the things that we hear about the regime in this grassroots way is you get a flavor of the atmospherics and some of the things that give us a flavor or snapshot of what's going on in a particular part of the region. And there's a lot of complaining, and I think this is great information to come out of North Korea. But what we see is that there is a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of some isolated criticism of the regime. But the problem is that these criticisms are not connected. That these are isolated incidents of critiquing the regime, and not the harbinger of something of a people rising up.
We have just time for one last question from audience, and that is, given the fact that information on the outside world has been leaking into North Korea over the years, what are your thoughts on why there has not been yet an uprising from its people or an inside assassination similar to the death of former South Korean President Park Chung-hee? So why hasn't there been an uprising?
Yeah, the people are too isolated. They're not connected in that way that would spur a collective action, and collective action against or protest is when the Arab Spring happened, that there was a sense that this is the start of a new era where the people will rise up as a result of technology. But what we've seen in technology in North Korea is that they're not connected to each other, and that these are heavily monitored, and that people are still very careful about what they say. So there are the horizontal connections that would need to be that are necessary for any kind of protest, you're not going to see. I think and this is the irony of all of this, is that I think the North Korean people are so resilient that they're able to adapt. That so many decades of living under the Kim family, they've lived through the famine, they lived through weather events, they've lived through a period of want, and they're living through this regime. But the difference now is that they're making money, and they're making lots of it. And you're not going to see massive uprisings as a result of the fact that there are enough people earning money. And I have to say this one point too, is that Kim is trying to encourage that. Kim is trying to encourage you too can make it big by having Pyongyang become the center of cosmopolitanism and modern luxuries. And it's a way of trying to keep those desires contained and directed toward inward and toward your self-improvement versus outward and overthrowing the regime. If the regime can keep up to date with keep people's aspirations and hopes, then I think you'll have some, you're going to have the status quo.
Okay, well, I think our time has come to an end. Thank you, Jung. Did you have any final comments?
No, just to thank you for everything, and to Brookings and to Ballantyne, and to all of you in the audience who joined us today. I'm really grateful and really proud of this book. And I hope that you like it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
So I also want to thank everyone for joining. Again, kudos to Jung for the most insightful book on a subject that is very timely and of great importance to U.S. national security. Writing a highly informed, substantive, objective analysis of one of the least known leaders in the world, that's not an easy task. So, and I have to tell you, this book is also highly readable in terms of history, just on overall narrative on North Korea. I promise it will resonate with everyone. It's whether you know a lot about North Korea or you know nothing about North Korea. I personally found it very enlightening because of Herb Jung's very dispassionate in a way, but very thoughtful, insightful analysis. And what I really loved about the book is that she goes into an explanation of why and how she came to her assessment and evaluation. So her analysis of Kim Jong-un and developments and all of that are not only interesting, it's very revelatory, even to, I think, so-called North Korea experts. So for example, if you're talking about, let's say, describing Chang Suk-taek's execution, and what transpired. She doesn't just talk about, she elaborates on what happened, but what the event reveals about Kim Jong-un. So, and so on. So, and so the book is very revelatory. Again, thank you, Jung, for writing this book. Thank you all for joining us today. Now go out and get this book and enjoy reading it.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.